This is The State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. The fight for women's rights has accelerated this year. Back in January, the Women's March produced crowds in hundreds of cities across the world. That mass protest was part of a women's movement that goes back more than a century. Another pivotal moment for the women's rights movement took place in Mexico City in 1975. It was International Women's Year, and the UN held a conference that brought women together from all around the globe. The event drew key players in feminism like Betty Friedan and Gloria Steinem. It also had women from poorer countries whose views were often at odds with their American counterparts. In her new book, scholar Jocelyn Alcott examines the conference and how it shaped feminism in the 1970s and beyond. The book is called International Women's Year, the greatest consciousness-raising event in history. Jocelyn Alcott is a history professor at Duke University and joins me now. Welcome.
Thank you so much for having me.
All right, so give us the backdrop now and tell us more about this conference and the International Women's Year 1975.
So the conference actually emerged as a year, as a theme year. The UN at that point was having a lot of theme years on things like the environment and human rights and so forth. And it started as a little bit of a Cold War ploy, which is that a Soviet-aligned NGO wanted to celebrate its 30th anniversary. So it was going to have a big conference, and it wanted to have this be International Women's Year and have it really centered on the triumphs of the sort of socialist project on women's rights. And the United States, which had been utterly uninterested in women's rights in general, although, you know, obviously there was a vast social movement, but the State Department was uninterested in women's rights, suddenly decided that it was going to throw a lot of money at this because it realized that the only event of International Women's Year was going to be in East Berlin. And so it decided that there had to be a different conference, and it had to be in a developing country, which was the term they used at the time. And it was an effort by the United States to really sort of curry favor among countries that at that point were considered part of the non-aligned movement. So the Soviet Union had, over the 60s and 70s, well, really 50s, 60s, and 70s, had kind of gained the upper hand around issues of racial discrimination and was sort of throwing that in the face of the United States, even after the Voting Rights Act and everything else. I mean, it continued to be a problem in the United States because racism continued to be a problem in the United States. And so the Soviet Union, the kind of Soviet-aligned countries, decided that women's issues would be the next area where they would kind of tweak the U.S. State Department.
Not that the Soviets had a better record on race, but it was very easy to point out the American failure to produce equality when it was trotting around the globe trying to win hearts and minds of developing countries using just that. Whereas with women, there was a little better record. I mean, women held important positions. They were doctors and they were cosmonauts and in ways that by 1975, that had not changed at all in the United States. So we didn't even look as good as the Soviets at that point.
I mean, there was a little bit, you know, we forget this now, but in the mid-70s, feminism and certainly the Equal Rights Amendment seemed pretty mainstream. You know, Betty Ford had come out in favor of it. And so it actually seemed like a place in the United States, we were sort of gaining some ground. But the United States did not compare well with a lot of other countries.
So talk about Mexico City and why finally it was held there.
So it's funny. Originally it was going to be in Bogota, and for various reasons, mostly because the Colombian representative was the person in the room that they managed to buttonhole to be like, make it in Colombia. and Colombia was actually going through a democratic transition. And so when the government changed from one party to the other, they decided they didn't want to host it. And Luis Echeverria, who was the president of Mexico at the time, was dying to become the next Secretary General of the UN. I mean, Mexico has limited, you get a 1 6-year term as president. And, you know, like many other places, the convention is that once you're done being president, you kind of fade out, right? Or you fade out from Mexican politics. And so he was looking into what his next act was. And his next act, as he saw it, was on the world stage. And he had sort of positioned himself as a leader of what was then called third worldism, on a number of issues, in particular issues around economic sovereignty. And so he really spotted an opportunity. And there's an interesting exchange where he says, you know, I do not mean to offend my Colombian colleague, but if it's all the same to you, and orchestrates to have it in Mexico City, and is very quick to make sure that Mexico is completely in line with UN ideals. So they put in a population control program, which was a big UN priority. He actually, in a very presidentialist way, since Mexico passes an equal rights amendment. So the Mexican Constitution, as of the end of 1974, says man and woman are equal before the law. which, you know, at the time when the United States was really struggling with the Equal Rights Amendment, was, I think, an effort to say, look, we know how to do this stuff. Yeah.
So they did that. It's in Mexico City. The UN is behind it. There is going to be this official United Nations conference now, the capstone of the year of the International Year of Women. And then pretty soon, or close to the event itself, a second conference emerges. And tell us about the development of that and the organization of that second conference.
Of the East Berlin Conference.
No, I mean in Mexico City, the official and the unofficial.
Right. So this had been, this was, I think, the third of these thematic conferences that had a parallel NGO conference. The first two were the Population Conference and the Environment Conference, which took place, Population in Bucharest and Environment in Stockholm. And the interesting thing was that, you know, in the mid-70s, NGOs, non-governmental organizations, as they were called, so NGOs, really mushroomed. It's an explosion. Again, you know, by the 90s, we think of NGOs as being kind of everywhere. But in the 70s, it really seemed like this radical democratic option at a time when there was a lot of concern about government corruption, government ineptness, right? This is right on the heels of Watergate and all this stuff, that civil society was what was going to save democracy. We have a much more critical perspective on that now. But at the time, I think it's important to remember at the time, there was this just deep sense of hope, I think, particularly for groups like women and other marginalized groups that didn't see a space for themselves in formal politics. So the NGO Tribune, which was this amazing thing happens with it, which is that they decide they're going to have an NGO Tribune. And initially, the planning is done by a real Cold War hawk. But it gets taken over just by appointment. The woman who's set to organize it is an activist from the YWCA, which is an organization that historically has been really involved with civil rights and anti-racism campaigns. So she's from Virginia. She'd come up through civil rights stuff. And she's this very sort of gracious, you know, she writes lots of very warm notes to people. And she decides that the NGO Tribune, instead of being this very staid, protocol-driven event, which was going to include only what were called consultative status NGOs, so NGOs that had official UN recognition, she said, why don't we just open it up? And we'll say, instead of just being consultative status, it will just have it be any NGO. So any NGOs that are legit NGOs can sign up and they can participate in this conference, in this NGO Tribune. And so they start doing that, and at one point they decide that she's going to open it up further and say not only that any NGOs can come, but that anybody who is an activist and who registers can come. So then they have a whole registration process, and then about 2 days into the conference, to the complete horror of all of the security personnel, she decides that anybody who shows up at the front door can come into the Tribune. And they've organized it in such a way that they've left a ton of open space. So you have all of these people from radically diverse backgrounds and a lot of physical meeting space and time on the schedule to get into arguments. And it's incredibly generative to have this space.
Well, and the first argument is over whether she should have done that, right? I mean, the question about, I mean, it sounds terribly egalitarian and democratic, so who could be against that? But there were objections, particularly from the American contingent, right?
And there was this concern from Americans in particular that what they call disruptors were just going to take over, that it would be a place where people would just march in and start protesting and nothing would get done. And, you know, people think of all the protests happening in the 60s, a lot of protests were still happening in the 70s. Yeah. And in particular, the UN was a space of immense, immense protest. It really had been the General Assembly by that point had been really taken over by the non-aligned countries. They had suspended the credentials of South Africa over apartheid. They were sort of going after Israel. Mm-hmm. It was, you know, so there were a lot of
those countries,
tensions.
Non-aligned with the Soviet Union directly or the United States. Right.
And which were predominantly in what was then called the Third World.
Third World, yeah. So there is a protest movement, concern among Americans, among others, that this was a far too open event. And this was actually an insight into some of the deep fissures that divided sort of American feminists from other feminists around the world. And these became apparent at that Tribune.
Yeah. I mean, what was really striking, I was surprised to see how frank many U.S. feminists were. And it was not all U.S. feminists. It was a particular sector that I think was mostly found in the National Organization for Women. So Betty Friedan and the president of NOW, who was a woman named Karen DeCrow, and the president of the New York City NOW, who was a woman named Jacqueline Ceballos, were really prominent in this. And they were absolutely certain that their job was to come educate third world women about proper and authentic feminism. And they were completely upfront. I mean, Betty Friedan says to a reporter, we are our sister's keeper. Right. Our job is to go down there and tell them how it's done. And the education really went the other way. Right. They really got a education in how flexible feminism needed to be if it was going to be actually a global movement.
Well, that's one of the important outcomes of this. But let's talk about how it's being reported at the time. And there's a particular AP photo that I think is illustrated.
Yes, there's this wonderful AP photo that was the most – it's probably the image that most people saw. And it was depicted as being from the conference, but it really was from the NGO Tribune. So these aren't diplomats. These are activists in this picture. And it's a picture of two women wrestling over the microphone at the NGO Tribune. And what is fascinating to me about it is, first of all, that it was so widely circulated because it fit a narrative that a lot of journalists had, which was that women would never get along. It was going to be what they called a global catfight. The other thing that struck me about it was when I finally – actually, I was at the National Humanities Center here in Research Triangle Park, and the librarian there, Brooke Andrade, got me the original AP photo. And so you can see the uncropped photo. And what you see is two women indeed – arguing over the microphone next to some women who were smiling and laughing. It's clearly a kind of more comic rather than combative moment in some ways. And I think that it was such a great metaphor for the whole thing, was it gets cropped down to this one fight, you know, which was not – the fights were important and the fights were in some ways the most – gender apart, but
I mean, it turns out that they it's not necessarily that they were in an argument, but both of them were struggling to sort of make the point, and perhaps the same point. So it was less about, no, you're wrong, give me the mic. It was, yeah, this is so important, you know, let's both say this. It's possible that was it, again, given the looks on the faces of the people around them. But let's talk about the things that did divide them, because there were important differences in the perception of feminism and what the goals would be, and whether it could be an international movement or whether it would be an organization of multiple movements.
Yeah. And, you know, so the most striking one and the one that in some ways persists today and that's heartbreaking to see is there was a real zero-sum game set up between human rights on the one hand, and in particular the rights of many Chileans who were in exile in Mexico City, who had fled the Pinochet regime in Chile, and who would talk about what were truly brutal, unconscionable human rights abuses that were taking place at that point in Chile. And other groups, in particular the ones that they were sort of set in opposition to, were the women who were fighting for various forms of sexual rights, and in particular the rights of lesbians to have all kinds of civil rights and of sex workers to have certain kinds of labor rights. So prostitutes and lesbians, as they were called, were always lumped together and put off to one side in opposition to human rights activists. And the women from the United States wanted no part of either of these groups, right? They wanted to focus on things like access to education and training, salary parity, political access, that kind of thing. So there was this sense that these groups would never be able to make common cause. They really do much later, but there were literally logistical – there would be protests at different ends of the city on these two opposing issues. So that was, I think, a real struggle. It was a – I should say the sort of – lesbian sex worker contingent always supported human rights. The reverse was not the case.
Yeah, and it was perhaps most poignant. There was a particular woman from Bolivia who gained a fair amount of attention and I think put the conference in stark relief.
Yeah, so Domitila Barrios de Chungara was a Bolivian activist, and she was the leader of what was called the Housewives Committee, which is a committee of a union, and which was completely misread by U.S. feminists or U.S. women in general as being some super domestic the NGO Tribune organizer Mildred Persinger thinks that she bakes these biscuits and sells them for school uniforms or something. And she was not at all baking biscuits. She was on a hunger strike and getting thrown in prison and things on these very intense labor conflicts. And she had a really highly developed Marxist sensibility about, you know, the way the world worked and the way the power was structured, and a vast critique of a lot, particularly of U.S. policies, but of international capitalism. And so she came in and really became the standard bearer for this critical contingent. She then became famous because she wrote a memoir that was widely assigned all over the world in college classrooms. But she was very, very critical. In fact, she talks about her moment of alienation from this conference in Mexico City being when she starts encountering lesbians and sex workers, right? That's the moment that sort of completely turns her off. And she says, you know, these are not my problems. I have other problems. And so it really becomes this, it's a great metaphor for the difficulty of weaving those things together. How do we get her to think that the problems of sex workers are the same as her problems?
And if we just walked away from the conference with only the perhaps that story and that AP photo in mind, we would think that it left in tatters. But you talk about, and I think you made reference to it earlier, the fact that there was some learning that went mm-hmm. on, and particularly among American feminists, who began to see that there was a new way of understanding or different way of understanding.
Yeah. So a lot of U.S. women came back really having had an education in terms of the vast range. And I mean, not women who were naive or new to activism. Women like Dorothy Height, like really seasoned activists, came back saying, you know, these are women who walk 5 kilometers to get water. I mean, it's a whole different world out there, and really thinking in new and interesting ways about where they needed to focus their attention. But the other thing that happened was a lot of these women from third world countries decided they needed to form their own networks. And they decided that precisely because of this kind of condescension they perceived from that. There's this great line where Devaki Jain, who's a young development economist from India, says, you know, we're at the conference and all these Americans, they say, you punks, you're just disrupting this conference. And that's when I realized that I had, and she forms what is an organization called Dawn, the Development Alternatives for Women for a New Era, which is a very clunky name, but for a wonderful organization. Right. Where the requirement to be a member in Dawn is you have to live in the developing world. You can't live in New York City or London and be a member. And so it's a really and they really saw that material difference as being critical.
So is that, I mean, that sounds like a good thing. Everybody comes to a different understanding and perhaps a more critical understanding of where they are and what their relationship is. On the other hand, it feels like you're ever more divided in a world where, you know, sort of the people who have power and wealth love to see the resistance divided. Was this a good thing, do you think?
So I think it was a good thing in the sense that there was I think a lot of women, and most especially U.S. women, came in with this idea that everybody needed to achieve unity was the key word, unity, and in the government conference had a consensus, but that everybody needed to unite around a single program. And they seemed a bit oblivious to the idea that what unity meant was you get on my train, right? And by the end of the conference, and certainly by the end of this series of UN conferences, UN women's conferences, because there were 3 more after this, there's a deep understanding that there's a lot of differences, that groups need to caucus around their own interests, but they also need to be working together. And so there was, I think, and at this point, not just around women's issues, these networks are very involved in the environmental conferences, the population conferences, all of these different sort of issue-based or thematic conferences. But with the understanding that there's these multiple stages, one where you're caucusing with people who maybe share a bit more of your own experience, and another set of stages where you're interacting with other groups and talking about what their needs are and how you might collaborate.
Did that lesson or those lessons mature? In other words, what's the legacy today of that conference?
So, well, NGOs, as you well know, are now vast and multifaceted, and in some ways they're a little problematic and on some scores, but that form, both the NGOs themselves and the networks of them, has really dramatically changed the way that global feminism looks. And so I mentioned there are 3 conferences that follow. There's one in Copenhagen that was supposed to be in Tehran, but then there was a revolution there, so got moved, and one in Nairobi, and then the most recent one in 95 in Beijing, which most people remember for Hillary Clinton speaking there. But a lot of other things also happened in Beijing. And when you look at those, what you start to see is a lot more, first of all, that the U.S. women coming are much more aware of the need to be cognizant of the diversity of experiences and needs and objectives around the world. But that these networks are, I think, it's not that there weren't transnational networks before, but there were more sort of white glove, you know, the YWCA or the International Planned Parenthood Federation, right? These are more popular networks. And I think that has really had a huge impact.
Jocelyn Olcott, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Her book is called International Women's Year, the greatest consciousness-raising event in history. There's more at our website, stateofthings.org. Just ahead, the music of Che Apalache. Stay tuned.